House Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules to Order. And I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 700. And I see that we have some illustrious guests here to tell us about this bill. Good morning. Welcome to the Elections Committee.
Thank you very much, Chair Rosenbaum. I'm Senator Rod Monroe, District 24, Chair of the committee that this bill came out of, the Committee on Legislative Reform. And with me is Senator Frank Morse, Vice Chair of the committee. Senate Bill 700 deals with creating a compensation commission. The compensation commission will be appointed by the governor, two members by the governor, one member by the president of the Senate, one member by the Speaker of the House, and the rest of the members are chosen by lottery. This is the way they do it up in Washington. There would be six members chosen by lottery, one from each congressional district, one at large. They would be citizen members who would have to have voted in at least the last two general elections. And, of course, they would have to agree to serve. They would not receive any compensation for their service, but would be paid the necessary expenses to travel to Salem or wherever they decide to meet. The Compensation Commission would have the job of recommending salaries for judges, for state legislators, and for all statewide elected officials. You're probably aware that our judges are paid about the poorest of any judges in the nation. And some people think that our legislators aren't paid much better. I'll let Senator Moore speak to that a little bit. Then what would happen would be this appointment would take place as soon as we shut down here in July, and these people could start meeting in the fall, would come back with their recommendations before Christmas, by mid-November, and the legislature, and here's where we get around this needing this to be constitutional, the legislature would have the power in the special session in February to accept and fund or to reject or to modify the recommendations of the Salary Commission. Those recommendations then would take effect July 1, 2008.
The retroactive
period. Okay.
That just added a bit to the fiscal, I think.
You're an old history teacher. You tend to think in terms of the past. 2008. And after that, they would meet every odd-numbered year. And so they would meet every 2 years. So they would meet in 1908, they would meet every even number of years. They'd meet in 1907, no. They would meet 2007, it's too early on Monday morning, 2007, then they would meet again in 2008, and then 2010, 2012, and so on. We had a question of whether or not this needed to be constitutional, and if in fact their recommendations automatically took effect, then it would need to be constitutional. But since the legislature, will have the authority to accept, reject, or modify their recommendations, it can be done statutorily, according to the legal opinion. This measure passed the Senate with only one negative vote, and I think it's a good measure that will solve some problems that we've had for a long time. I'd like Senator Morse to specifically speak about how he believes this will impact the legislative body.
Good morning, Senator.
Thank you. For the record, Frank Morse, Senator from District 8, Albany and Corvallis. The issue of public compensation for elected officials is one that is exceedingly difficult to deal with. And I think that's evidenced by the fact that we do have what is called a Public Officials Compensation Commission that presently exists in statute. But the members' terms expired in 2000, and that's 7 years ago, and they have never been renewed. And there's a great reluctance on the part of us as legislators to set our own salaries, because no matter what we do, we are criticized. Having served on the Public Commission on the Legislature, one of four legislators to do so, two from the Senate and two from the House, this was one of the major bills that came out by way of recommendations from the Public Commission. And the concepts arose from the field trip that a number of us made to the Washington Legislature when they were meeting in their supplementary session. And what they do, as Senator Monroe explained, is they have broad representation from the state of Washington that not just makes recommendations, they in fact set the salaries. And those salaries are not subject to change by the legislature. So it's a little bit different. They have that constitutional authority. We're not prepared to ask for that. We think it should be done by statute. But what you'll notice when you read the bill, the word shall is a pretty directive term. And it's the intent of the of the Public Commission on the Legislature in bringing forward this recommendation that the commission, in fact, would be the body that sets the salaries for the statewide elected officials, the judiciary, and legislators. I think that probably concludes my comments. There are a number of things that we could talk about, but Madam Chair, members of the committee would ask for your support for this bill.
Thank you for your testimony.
Madam Chair, can I just make one final comment? I thought maybe Senator Morris would say this, but he's a little kind. I've looked at the legislature for a long time. I was first elected to the legislature 30 years ago, and I've looked at it at who can afford to serve down here. And I've concluded, really, that a lot of regular working people really can't afford to serve down here. Unless you have a spouse that supports you, or unless you're independently wealthy, or unless you're like I am, kind of semi-retired on a pension, you really, can't afford to have a living wage and serve down here. We're cutting out an awful lot of very well-qualified people that could serve the state of Oregon very well and very effectively, but they really feel like they can't afford to even think about serving in the legislature. Hopefully, this measure ultimately will broaden the base of people that are available for this job.
I might just comment, because thank you. You reminded me of additional comments that I would like to make. The Public Commission on the Legislature discussed this issue extensively, and the conclusion was that people in public service should have a motive for public service, and that's truly what it is, that there are sacrifices to be made. But on the other hand, we should not, in public service, undertake a vow of poverty to serve publicly. And for many folks, that, in fact, is the case and the sacrifices that are made. And it precludes people who otherwise would jump into this arena and say, yeah, I would like to serve. So that, and bringing forward this recommendation from the Public Commission, that was a strong, strong element in this, because there is a presumption that the compensation for many public officials is not adequate. I would point out, interestingly enough, it was presented to me in meeting with the local judges in my district, circuit court judges, that the director of Parks and Recreation in my city of Albany receives compensation in excess of the Supreme Court Justice of Oregon. That's an interesting comparison. So we do have some work to do, clearly. We heard on Ways and Means in our travels around the state with respect to the compensation of our judiciary. And we're driving people away from positions that should be the top of the professional ladder in the legal profession. And it's something that we need to address. It's a very, very serious issue.
Thank you for your testimony, Senators. Any questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Berger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, gentlemen, for bringing this forward. This needs to happen, and I actually looked at similar legislation and sponsored some similar legislation early in the session, but yours has moved forward, and I'm very pleased to see it. The one question that I have, and I don't know if you're qualified to answer, but maybe other people are going to come up later, and that is around the judge's salary and whether in Washington or others that have a model such as this, whether they exclude attorneys from serving on this panel, since sort of the attorney-judge thing is a interesting relationship, and whether there's been thought. I mean, if these citizen members are drawn by lot, is there any reason or way, or is it even a good idea to exclude attorneys since they'll be setting salaries for judges?
Well, Representative Berger, we talked about this last week, and our committee had not dealt with that issue. It hadn't come up. So obviously you've thought about this a lot, and we did some investigating. We checked and found that in the state of Washington, there actually is an attorney that serves as a citizen member who was drawn by lottery, who serves and who votes, including on judges' salaries, and they don't feel that there's a conflict there. We checked with the Oregon Bar Association. They don't feel there's a conflict, but they felt like it would be up to the individual attorney. The individual attorney felt like there was a potential conflict. They could recuse himself on that particular vote. But we don't believe that it will be necessary, for example, for us to ban lawyers from serving as lottery-selected public members of this. If you happen to pick out the ping pong ball with a lawyer on it, and that person wants to serve, that they probably would serve effectively, and they represent a section of the overall electorate.
Fellow, I appreciate it, and I appreciate you did this research, because on reflection, I agree that it probably, if it's picked by lottery, it makes no sense to exclude a certain faction, and if it's worked in other states and the bar is okay with it, I think I would be too. Thank you.
Madam Chair,
Senator.
Representative Berger, you will notice in the text of the bill that one member is also appointed by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and there's nothing in the bill that would preclude that appointment being someone from the legal profession.
Yes. Thank you. Other questions for these witnesses?
Okay, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Two more people signed up to testify on this bill, and I'll call them both up together, Cappy Eaton and Mark Nelson.
An early good morning, Madam Chair.
Oh, they're going to be coming earlier.
Members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cappy Eaton. I'm the governance coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. The League is a grassroots, nonpartisan political organization that encourages informed participation in government. I'm here this morning on behalf of the League to support Senate Bill 700A. We have watched its development all the way through the Senate, and also with the discussions at the Public Commission on the Legislature and the Oregon Law Commission. We believe that the legislators should not have the unenviable task of providing their own compensation. The commission brings more transparency to state government, which we believe is in the public interest. An important inclusion in this legislation is the compensation for legislators for expenses, as outlined in Section 8. Both the Public Commission and the All Law Commission believe that this additional expense funds for legislators will be particularly important to avoid personal use of campaign funds and to provide more accountability in expenditures. There has been additional discussion of these issues during the consideration of the several ethics bills that are also still moving to the legislature. The League supports the inclusion of judicial salaries within the scope of the Public Officials Compensation Commission. As you may know, the League has just completed a two-year study of the judicial system in Oregon. And we were, to put it mildly.
If you could just back a little away from the microphone, it's very sensitive.
Thank you.
Better
I keep forgetting that. Thank you. In our study, we were absolutely appalled to find that the level of judicial salaries across the state was the state that it's in. And so we have, from the very beginning, supported the idea that the judicial salary part be included with the Public Compensation Commission. We applaud the inclusion as well of the commission's timeline to bring it forward by the end of this year so that it can be considered in the special session in 2008 with its salary recommendations for the remainder of the biennium. We also are very grateful, I guess is the term, that we wouldn't have the possibility of possibly opposing it, putting it in the Constitution. We feel that the Constitution is the framework for this state, and we should keep statutory matters out of it. We believe that 700A is a very positive step forward, and we urge the committee to move it forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Madam Chair, my name is Mark Nelson, representing the Oregon Judges Association. The association brought this matter to the attention of the Public Commission on the Legislature when they were looking at legislative salaries, and we felt it was important that we look at all public officials' compensation in that process. Some of you may know that years and years ago I used to work for then State Treasurer and then Attorney General Jim Redden, and salaries, not his own salary, but salaries for legislators and public officials were one of his key passions. And I remember standing at the end of the session, literally the last day of the session, on at least two or three occasions, back behind the dais, working with the Speaker or the Senate President on trying to get the last vote for public official salaries. And literally it came down to that each time because it was that political. And so this commission, in my mind, Madam Chair, will bring some outside eyes to this process, some expertise which will, I hope, depoliticize this process, not only for you but for all other public officials in the state. So I urge your passage.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for these witnesses? Okay, thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 700? Okay, then I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 700.
I'm going to move it.
And we will be taking this bill up at our hearing on Wednesday, and we will, I'm sure, be moving it at that time. Next, let's go to... for anyone in the audience who's here for House Bill 3432, we will not be taking that up this morning. We'll be carrying that over to Wednesday as well, so you don't have to wait around for that. And I think we'll next go to 3088. I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3088A. And do we have a sign-up sheet, Shana? Yes, Mr. Stembridge, please tell us about this bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3088A prohibits hospitals from billing or attempting to collect from uninsured patients charges that exceed either the Medicare rates or rates paid by the hospital's highest volume commercial insurer. It allows patients to claim treble damages and attorney's fees if hospital bills or attempts to collect charges that are in violation of the Act. It takes effect on the 91st day following the adjournment sine die. We do have a fiscal that arrived Actually, yesterday, your hardworking fiscal staff was in on Sunday and delivered that to us. It should be in your packet. If you don't have it, I have a copy I can give to you.
It doesn't appear that we have it in front of us, Jim.
No.
Well, we would love it.
Yeah, actually it is. No, I think it may be at the bottom of the stack.
I got it.
Tried to carefully hide them, so.
Good job.
Very successful.
Very good job.
Okay. I should also announce that we apparently had some confusion about whether we were having public testimony on this bill today or not, so we will not be moving it today, but we will take additional public testimony when we carry it over to our hearing on Wednesday. So we have one witness signed up to testify, and I will call Lynn Marie Kreider.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, good morning. I am Lynn Marie Kreider. I represent SEIU, and we have been working on this bill, and so I'd like to spend a few minutes going through it with you. You will have written testimony that's in the form of a sort of PowerPoint presentation, but because I'm scared of technology, we do it on paper. I think Mr. Stembridge explained the key pieces of the bill. If you have your bill in front of you, the most important language is in Section 3 at page 1, lines 11 to 15, which says a hospital may not charge a person without insurance more than either Medicare or its highest volume commercial insurer. And then what it says is that the hospital chooses which benchmark to use. So the hospital would choose either to benchmark uninsured rates to Medicare or to the highest volume commercial insurer. In my testimony, I refer to this bill as creating parity between rates charged to the uninsured and to the insurance company, because that will generally be the higher rate that the hospital could choose. The problem that is addressed by the bill is that basically we have more than 600 Oregonians who have no health insurance. Hospital care is obviously very expensive, and hospitals right now charge the highest prices of all to the uninsured, although they generally are those least able to pay. So the solution that we've proposed to that, to a small piece of that problem, is to say, to cap what hospitals can charge to the uninsured at what they can charge, at what they do charge, actually, to the insurer with whom they do the most business. On page 4 of my testimony, I pose the question, can Oregon's $6 billion a year hospital industry afford to lower its annual revenue by about $15 million we project in the aggregate in order to be fair to Oregonians without insurance? And I'll explain a little bit about why we think it costs so little, in fact, to do this. On page 5, a graph that you may have seen many times that shows the number of Oregonians or the percentage of Oregonians without insurance. So this bill is protecting some 16-17% of the population that has no insurance. On page 6, I tell you something about who those without insurance are. Most Oregonians without health insurance are low or middle income families. Unfortunately, this is true in Oregon, it's true nationwide, that folks who have good incomes, that have a good wage tend to have employer-paid insurance, and those with low incomes tend not to have it. About 75% of Oregonians without insurance are in households under 300% of poverty. About 7% over 500% of poverty, and I give you the what that translates into dollars. This bill is most important in helping middle-income families because, as you know, hospitals have charity care programs. Commonly, those programs provide free care to patients up to 150-200% of poverty. Many of them have a sliding scale kind of reduction in the charge to patients from 200-400% of poverty. So it's the people that are above the charity care thresholds that are most likely to hit by this. We had in the healthcare committee, when they heard this bill, we had testimony from one of your colleagues who explained when she had fallen through the cracks and didn't have health insurance. She and her husband worked. It wasn't that they had no money, but they had a very big bill to try to pay themselves. It's that kind of person that this bill helps. The next page talks to you about what the full charges are. In the United States, hospital sticker prices, the listed charge, have been going up much more rapidly over the last 20 years than the cost of providing the service. So if you were to graph the cost, it would be going up about 6% a year. If you are graphing what's happening to charges, they're going up more than 10% a year. So sticker prices are getting higher and higher. And what's happening is that hospitals negotiate discounts for insurance companies. And those discounts mean that insurance companies are paying a relatively similar price over time relative to cost, but the uninsured are being charged more and more relative to cost. Page 8 shows you over time this cost versus price question. So you see the squares going across. That is the percentage of hospital cost that is being paid by commercial insurers. About 120% of cost, maybe 125% of cost. That's a national figure. The diamond line is what is being charged to the uninsured, and that, as you see, going up very rapidly. In Oregon, the last year for which we have data, it's over 200%, so more than twice the cost is what's being charged to the uninsured. My next slide just gives you some examples of what hospital services cost. I won't go into that. You know it's expensive. You don't want to go in and have to pay for it out of pocket. Let me address some of the questions that have been raised in these halls. Some hospital representatives say that hospitals ought to be allowed to charge people without insurance twice what it costs to provide the service because they don't want people to have an incentive not to have insurance. So the suggestion is that somehow people choose not to have insurance because they figure, what the heck? I'm going to get the same discount as an insurance company. But my next slide talks to you about why people say they don't get insurance in a national survey recently done by the Urban Institute. Many of them say that the cost is too high, more than half. And a very large number, as you will see, talk about some dislocation in their lives that's caused them to lose insurance. they've lost their job, they've changed their job, and their insurance has gone with it. They were on Medicaid. They got a job finally, and they've lost their insurance. Or they're a young person who used to be covered on their parents' plan, and they're too old now, or they've left school, and they don't have insurance. They've been divorced, and they lose. So those are the kinds of reasons why it's, you see, only 4% say, I never had insurance, I don't need insurance, or refuse to tell the interviewers why. So I would suggest to you that people don't choose not to have insurance because they think, what the heck, I can get a cut rate deal anyway. Health insurance is obviously very expensive. I give you those figures on page 12. So relative to middle income, family income, very big slice. Can hospitals afford to limit their charges to uninsured patients? Some hospital representatives say they can't afford to do that, but let's look at the facts. 14 of Oregon's 57 hospitals already give discounts of some kind to all uninsured patients. Some of those are smaller than the discounts that they provide to insurers, but some of them are actually currently benchmarking to insurers. Among those are Curry General Hospital on the South Coast, 40% discount automatic. They do it. Providence Hospitals, under the settlement that they reached when they were sued for overcharging the uninsured, agreed to provide discounts automatically equal to what they called their Providence preferred rate. In addition, there are several hospitals that provide discounts equal to their insured discounts if people pay on a payment plan within 18 months. So it's being done by some hospitals in Oregon, and I think that's some indication that it's possible. Another reason that it's possible is that basically hospitals don't now make money on the uninsured, despite the very high charges. One reason is that uninsured people don't go to the hospital as much as you would as other people do. Whereas 16 to 17% of the population in Oregon is without insurance, only about 5% of the people that go to hospitals are uninsured. And I'm measuring that by the volume of charges. Apparently, people avoid going to the hospital if they can't pay the bill, which makes some sense. Another reason why hospitals don't make a lot of money on people without insurance is that they can't collect what's paid. So hospitals report that they collect about 20% of what they bill to the uninsured. And that is after they provide some free care, some charity care. So you have that 5% who go to the hospital. A significant chunk of that 5% that go to the hospital get free care, so they don't get a bill. And then of those that the hospital doesn't provide charity care, collect about 20%. So that means that we're not talking about a big revenue stream. Unfortunately, what we're talking about is bills that go to people who try to pay because they have some pride in how they deal with their creditors and can't do it, and what happens to them as a consequence. Next, page 16 talks about some of the figures in terms of collections rates and what it would cost. So this is an injustice, we believe. The high charges to the uninsured, we believe, is an injustice and one that we can afford to correct. So what's happened now? I've told you some hospitals are already providing uninsured discounts. In California, the legislature last year passed a bill which I would call more of a financial assistance or charity care bill than this one is, in the sense that what it said is you can't charge low-income people, 350% of poverty or below, you can't charge those folks more than you charge either Medicare or Medicaid. So actually saying that for folks under 350% of poverty, you have to charge less than you would charge the insured. Excuse me. New York, a similar kind of program where they mandated free care. This is also very new, just went into effect at the first of the year. Mandated free care in hospitals receiving state assistance up to a certain level of poverty. Then the next kind of tier of people can only be charged 20% of what's charged to the uninsured, and then tiers up from there. This bill is more simple. It says regardless of income, there ought to be a limit on what can be charged to people without insurance. So it doesn't give the same kind of preference that New York and California, but it says we ought to apply this to everybody, not just low-income folks. With that, let me offer to answer any questions you may have.
Okay. Any questions for this witness? Yes, Vice Chair Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Kreider, the last page of your presentation mentions the Maryland system, and I wonder if you have any information at how long Maryland's had their policies in place and what the impact that's had on revenue streams for hospitals.
Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, that system, Maryland says that all payers have to be charged the same amount. So Medicare, Medicaid, insured, uninsured. That's been in place for about 30 years. It's my understanding that it's worked. It's been supported by the hospital association there, obviously with some angst at times, I'm sure. It is somewhat different because Medicare and Medicaid are paying that same rate, but we don't have any reason to believe that it leads folks to choose not to have insurance or that kind of thing.
One follow-up, Manager?
Follow-up.
Thank you for that answer, too. And I just wanted to point out in Section 3, as you mentioned, of House Bill 3088, a hospital can choose either the Medicare rate or the hospital's highest volume insurer. So that is a distinction from the Maryland program.
Well, the Maryland program, Representative Buckley, requires a hospital to charge everyone the same. So it is a regulated rate. In fact, I should have pointed that out, that is established by a rate-setting commission that figures out what is a reasonable rate that, if paid by everyone that comes to the hospital, will maintain the an adequate revenue stream for the hospital.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Hunt.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Lynn Marie, two slides before the one Peter just referenced was the slide about hospitals don't rely on income from the uninsured to balance their books, and then you talk about the percentage that they receive in terms of their patient revenue from patients without insurance.
Correct.
My understanding is we've got a wide array of hospitals, some which, you know, have large systems that support them and have very profitable centers and not so profitable centers. And then there are single silo community-based hospitals like the one that serves my district, Willamette Falls in Oregon City, that really, at least for the last several years, have not been operating on any kind of a profit margin and are skating very close every year in terms of their revenues. So I guess, help me understand, I look at even these percentages, knowing how Willamette Falls operates, and it seems like, it just doesn't seem like the statement that they don't rely on income from the uninsured to balance their books, it just doesn't seem like that would be an accurate statement for a hospital like Willamette Falls. Help me understand, reconcile that.
Madam Chair, Representative Hunt, I suppose perhaps I used a somewhat overbroad comment. If they receive any revenue from the uninsured, yes, it makes some contribution. It is simply that for hospitals look to get commercially insured patients, they don't collect very much from the uninsured. So I would be happy to kind of do a run on what, from the publicly reported data, it looks like the impact of this would be on Willamette Falls Hospital. I haven't done that.
And I had a question that sort of follows on the lines of Representative Hunt's. When hospitals track uncompensated care, I guess you could call that charity care, is there an incentive for them to have that care valued at a higher rate? I mean, would discounting that cause it to look like they were providing less free care than they currently are?
Chair Rosenbaum, historically, the way hospitals have reported charity care is in the gross charges or sticker price. So if I have heard insurance company execs say, one of the reasons that we believe that gross charges are going up so much faster than what's actually being paid by the insurance companies is it allows hospitals to sort of inflate what their charity care looks like. I have no idea whether that's a piece of it. I do, as you will recall, there is a bill that the House has passed that requires the reporting of charity care at cost. So I think if that's been a factor in the past, it's probably going to be a diminishing factor.
Thank you. Other questions for this witness? Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. We have two other people signed up to testify on this bill, and I'll call them together, Bruce Bishop and John Lee. And I think we have quite a few people here for House Bill 3437, so we will take that up next. I think we'll have to ask to be excused from the floor session, and hopefully they will not demand our presence before we hear from all of those witnesses.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is John Lee. I'm a senior advisor for Providence Health System, and prior to my retirement, I served for 35 years in healthcare in Oregon, and most recently is with Providence Health System for 25 years, where I was chief executive. There are a few important points we'd wish to emphasize. The stated missions of most Oregon hospitals, including Providence, express a commitment to the uninsured. During 2006, Providence provided $125 million of free care at cost, not at charges, at cost, and other benefits, and has been a leader in defining charitable assistance policies. Providence helps an average of 200 patients a day in need of financial assistance. Our financial assistance policies are transparent and available on the web. Generally, patients in need who are at or below 200% of the federal poverty level receive free care for any uncovered balance, and those at below 400% of federal poverty level receive discounts. A family of four at 200% of federal poverty level makes about $40,000 a year. Providence, like most other Oregon hospitals, strives to assure that the neediest Oregonians actually receive health services. We have a strong concern about legislating one discount system for all hospitals, as been referenced by Representative Hunt, because of the issue of Willamette Falls. Forcing Oregon hospitals to adopt an inflexible system could damage a very good program that helps thousands of Oregonians. We see several ways that bill would force hospitals to offer discounted care to those with means to pay. For example, the bill does not include definitions of medical necessity or residency. This would result in hospitals being forced to give deep discounts for elective surgeries, such as plastic surgery, to anyone who wants to come to Oregon to receive free or discounted care. In addition, the bill would require hospitals to provide financial assistance to someone with substantial means who chooses not to purchase health insurance. This kind of policy would result in significant additional cost shift to Oregon businesses or insurers. In conclusion, caring for the poor and vulnerable is at the heart of our mission, is what we hold ourselves accountable to every day, and yet this bill will severely curtail our ability to help the neediest among us. We appreciate the intent behind HB 3088, but ask you to set it aside and allow us to continue the good work already in place. Appreciate this opportunity to comment.
Please go ahead.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, appearing this morning on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. I'm here to register our strong opposition to House Bill 3088. The bill before you should not be enacted into law. It will have undesirable consequences on Oregon hospitals across the state. I'm also here to tell you that as much as I appreciate the Rules Committee's interest in health policy, I don't believe you have the time or ability to craft a piece of legislation that will have such significant consequences in this legislative session. Passing House Bill 3088 will not accomplish the purposes that you intend of helping low-income, uninsured Oregonians pay their hospital bills. I believe that's your goal. If you have another goal, I'd be glad to hear what that is. But I don't believe House Bill 3088 is going to advance that cause in a significant way. And in fact, I think it will have other consequences that will be detrimental to the health of Oregonians. I want to focus a little bit on two pieces of testimony that you've received, one written and one oral. You've received a letter from approximately 12 ministers of various denominations in the church. It's captioned Testimony in Support of House Bill 3088. The last paragraph of that testimony says, "It seems immoral to overcharge those with the least ability to pay simply because they do not have high-powered insurance companies to lobby on their behalf." I find that statement objectionable, because that's not what we're talking about. Oregon hospitals are not overcharging low-income people because high-powered insurance companies are lobbying on behalf of somebody else. I think it's regrettable that those signatories have taken that position. And I'm glad to discuss it with some or all of them, many of whom I know. This is not that issue. And I think tying back advocacy to House Bill 3088 is inappropriate. Every Oregon hospital has a policy, a charity care policy, to address the needs of low-income Oregonians. Every Oregon hospital has a financial assistance policy to assist people with moderate means to pay their hospital bills. House Bill 3088, for reasons that are somewhat unclear to me, targets hospital patients above the limits of charity care and financial assistance policy. Now, those policies vary in terms of who they benefit. But by and large, we're talking about higher income individuals who have the ability, who have some resources at least, and are not as low income as many of their peers. House Bill 3088 proposes a statewide standard that all hospitals will have to adhere to. In this respect, at this point, I don't believe a statewide standard is desirable. I think it will have unintended consequences and will not achieve the objective that the proponents seek. I'd also like to turn to Ms. Kreider's testimony and just point out what she's argued, starting at page 14. She says, "Some Oregon hospitals currently charge uninsured patients the same as the insured." That's true. But the qualifier is some. She then says, "Those hospitals can afford it," and offers a rationale for why they can. She argues that because some hospitals can afford it and can do it, that all hospitals should be required to do something similar. And that's frankly where we strongly disagree. As I've indicated, all hospitals already have charity care policies. All hospitals already have financial assistance guidelines to help those without the resources to pay their bills. But there is no basis, in our view, for adopting a statewide standard at this point. And we would urge you to oppose House Bill 3088 for that reason.
Questions for these witnesses? So I had a question, Mr. Lee, for you, because the earlier testimony said that Providence hospitals are already providing
care at a discounted rate, I believe, as a result of a lawsuit. So how would this affect Providence?
Well, it was a settlement in a class action suit. It wouldn't affect Providence. We're just concerned about the precedent that it sets. And we think that, you know, if you look at it, every hospital, and we have small hospitals in rural areas and whatever, and there's the majority of the hospitals in Oregon are in rural areas. Medicare does not pay full charges or full cost for many hospitals. Take these choices in the impact that it would have on rural areas it could be devastating. The other thing is, if you think about higher ed, there's a charitable financial aid program that the state has for its universities. The state actually funds those dollars that are given. The funding source for hospitals is somebody else. If we give a discount with somebody else or to somebody that has means, somebody else has to pay it. And we're in this terrible Robin Hood thing. It'd be great to have the program that's in Maryland, and I have a chart that shows what happened in Maryland. These are the payers. I'll arrange to get this distributed to the committee, but the federal government actually pays more for Medicare in Maryland than they do in any other state. They stepped up the payment. So what we have is Medicare and Medicaid do not pay costs. Somebody else has to pay it. And you have a group of people that choose not to be insured in Oregon. Most people you think logically would, but you know, we have the lottery and other things. People take a chance. And we don't want to be in a situation where people have means that can pay the bill and choose not to be insured, and we're required to give a discount. That's basically it. And I hope that makes some sense. But this does not have an adverse effect on Providence, per se. We're just concerned about the precedent that it sets.
Okay, thank you. And Vice Chair Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Gentlemen, I have a constituent who I met with at the end of last session, who's a mom with a family of four, and their health insurance costs were $850 a month. She was struggling. She was probably going to drop her insurance. She fits over that 200% of federal poverty line. What kind of, what should we say to her in terms of, she's not fitting within, comfortably within, you know, what the charity care would be. But what should we say to her when she has to try to take care of her kids and pay?
Well, in the case of Providence, we, if they're below 400%, between 200 and 400%, we will adjust the charges that's unpaid at that time. They may be eligible for programs. Whether it's if somebody is in her situation, the question is she eligible for Medicaid or not? If she's not eligible for Medicaid, then there are financial assistance policies, and they're in place in every hospital. And ours are on the web. I think usually if you can get into a primary care physician, whether it's a critical what are those clinics called? Federally Qualified Health Center. Usually if you can get into a primary care physician, the primary care physician will arrange the access to specialists in hospitals through that system. There are programs and systems in place. I don't know what her circumstances are, but if we could help, we'd be happy to.
I appreciate it. Could I do one follow-up, Madam
Chair?
Mr. Bishop, first off, I do appreciate your comments, though. I have great confidence in my colleagues' abilities to actually process legislation and actually make considered judgments on bills before us. I'd like to ask, does your association have information on Oregon's 57 hospitals that we might be able to access, what their programs are for low and medium income?
Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, yes, we do, and those data have been posted at OregonPricePoint.com. For the last 2 years.
Oh, I'm sorry.
All Oregon.
Oregon Prize Point?
Yes.
Thank you very much.
I think it's, I'll get it for you specifically. I think it may be OR Prize Point. Those data are available. Oregon is the first state to make those data available. All Oregon hospitals post their financial assistance policies, make them publicly available. I would like to respond to your question that Mr. Lee answered. By also pointing out that in the case of your constituent who is doing the right thing by having insurance for herself and her children, I don't understand the rationale for giving somebody else who is uninsured with the same or more income a better discount than she would be entitled to. I think there is an equity argument there about how public policy should address that issue. One approach would be to give care away to everybody. And, you know, we would have a very different hospital situation than we do today if that were the case. I don't think that's a result that we can affect, but many of the issues you're concerned about are being driven by governmental policies that result in underpayment both through the Medicare and the Medicaid program. We have made a concerted effort to increase Medicaid funding in the state because that's the program that you can address directly. If you invest 40 cents, you get 60 cents in federal dollars through the Medicaid program. We're doing a miserable job in this state in carrying out that program and providing assistance to low-income Oregonians. We're doing a much worse job today than we were doing 5 years ago, and we're not stepping up to the plate to restore that program. I think we shouldn't put our priorities here of providing a discount to higher-income people who decline to get insurance and have resources to be able to pay for their care.
I appreciate it. Just to be clear, though, she was on the verge of losing her insurance because she couldn't afford it. It wasn't that she was going to choose not to be insured. She simply could not afford her insurance premiums any longer.
And we need to make sure that we have ways to encourage and support people in obtaining insurance whenever possible.
Thank you very much.
And I guess my question would be, because both of your testimony seems to imply that people who don't have insurance are choosing not to, but we have an extremely high percentage of our population in Oregon without insurance. I don't know the exact figures, but it seems like it was something like over 600,000 people lack insurance at last count. Is it your testimony that you believe most of those people are uninsured because they're choosing not to have insurance?
Madam Chair, there's data out that there are about 20% of the uninsured have the means to purchase the insurance but choose not to do so.
So that would mean that about 80%.
That's correct. And we're not quibbling at all with giving financial assistance to people that don't have the ability to pay. That's not the issue. The issue is forcing us to put in a system that would give a discount to people that do have the means to pay but choose not to be insured.
So if this bill were modified so that it targeted just that 80%, would that neutralize your opposition to it?
It would, Providence's, but the association has to speak for itself.
Obviously, we would need to look at the language, but as I've indicated previously in my testimony, all Oregon hospitals already have charity care policies. They already have financial assistance policies, many of which go to assist families at 200% of income, some of which, to use Ms. Kreider's phraseology, go substantially beyond that. The question is, do we come up with a statewide mandate that requires everybody to do the same thing? And it's at that point that I think we risk creating unintended consequences in some communities who don't have the financial wherewithal to meet that standard. I'm not saying that some can't and that some don't, but a uniform statewide standard requiring a level of performance may have detrimental results in some communities.
Madam Chair, was the residency requirement was the other concern that we would have, even if you rectified the higher income people without an insurance, residency would be the other issue.
Okay. Other questions? Yes, Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess that the part that is interesting to me is that would you agree with the national statistics that the general rate charged is about 200% higher than cost, or 100% higher than cost?
I think for in metropolitan areas, the discount off of full bill charges or the deductions is about 50% today. And I can remember times in my history it was 20%. And what's happened is, I've got another chart, but I don't have it here. Medicare and Medicaid have dropped significantly below cost. The only place a hospital can get its money, it's forced into this Robin Hood rule, is from commercial payers, the remaining portion of the population. The hospital needs to cover all of its costs and make 6%. If it could do that, it would be fine. So it's forced every year, just like private universities, into this Robin Hood deal where you set a rate, and then you have commercial insurers that have come along with HMOs and PPOs and say, aren't we bringing you a lot of volume, and don't we deserve a discount? And, like, you know, that's the capital way. You know, you have, if someone brings you a lot of volume, you give a discount. And so we're in this situation where we've gone along with HMOs and PPOs, which get a discount. There's a few remaining indemnity plans that pay full bill charges. But to answer your question, yes, that's after you collect, yep, you post all your revenue and you take all your deductions for the amounts that Medicare doesn't pay and Medicaid and the write-offs for the HMO discounts and the PPO discounts, it's about 50%. We need a new system. We'd love Maryland's system. But, you know, how do we get there? And is this the best way to get there?
So, Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, if I can just add that in many cases that's the case, and those are, I think, the national data. But there are situations in Oregon where hospitals' charges and costs don't have that kind of spread. Those are averages, and we can't legislate an average without having effects on those who are below average now, raising them up, and maybe, you know, bringing down those who are above average. That's the effect of an average. But there are Oregon hospitals who don't have that kind of spread between their costs and their charges, a much narrower spread as a matter of policy. And, you know, some do, again, some don't.
So, hold on. It appears to me, then, basically, that the hospitals have decided to take a policy position hospital-wise to force people who have the means to buy insurance. I mean, it's kind of an insurance thing. You're forcing those people to say, wow, I'm going to have to pay twice as much as it actually costs if I want to have insurance, if I don't have insurance. And so you're kind of making that statement, but you're taking it across everyone. I mean, that's the part that is a little frustrating.
But Madam Chair and Representative Rumble, that's exactly what Massachusetts just did. They require everybody to buy insurance. So, I mean, it seems like that's the responsible thing to do if you can afford it. If you can't afford it, then what are the programs that fill in? And Medicaid is one. And then do we go high enough on Medicaid? I think that's the real issue, is do we go high enough up the federal poverty level on Medicaid in this state relative to other states? And our position is no. We need to go further up the federal poverty level for Medicaid eligibility.
Madam Chair, if I may, to your point about an increased number of uninsured, that is the case. But that is, in fact, the case of recent years. When the Oregon Health Plan was at its most robust and being well supported by the state in the late 90s, our uninsured rate came down. When funds were withdrawn from that program because of the recession and the economic depression that we had, our uninsurance rate went up. We know that there's a relationship between what Oregon pays in its Medicaid program and the uninsured rate. We should fix that problem. That's a higher priority problem to fix, in my view, than to address the needs of this population who don't qualify for charity care, who don't qualify for financial assistance. And at least in my book, that means that they have a higher level of income than those who are most needy.
Okay, thank you both for your testimony. And that is all the people we have signed up to testify on this bill today. We will carry House Bill 3088 over to our hearing this Wednesday. And I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3088 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3437. And we have a lot of people signed up to testify on this bill, so we're going to ask you to limit your testimony to no more than 3 minutes each. We'll call you in panels, and we will start with the supporters of the bill. I'll call Kelly Peterson, and Nicole Paquette, and Tony Vecchio.
And yes, Mr. Stembridge, could you please, I believe we have an amendment to this bill, and tell us about that.
Yes, Madam Chair, this is House Bill 3437, prohibits breeding of exotic animals, requires persons keeping exotic animals to obtain permits from the Department of Agriculture prior to the effective date of the Act. You have the Dash A9 amendment, which allows persons to breed small exotic cats if the persons are exempt from the permit requirement or if the persons have permits to keep the animals and document that the offspring are for retail sale. To breed the small exotic cats with domestic cats, it allows the Department of Agriculture to issue permits to keep exotic animals if application is made within 90 days of the effective date of the Act or within 1 year of the applicant's possessed by the animals prior to the effective date of the Act. It deletes provisions for order of crocodilia permits. It deletes provisions for temporary authorization to possess offspring of exotic animals that are gestational on the effective date of the Act, and it deletes provisions limiting permits to 2 years. It also deletes provision for renewal of permits, and it deletes the emergency clause. That's the 8th amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Stembridge. And I just noticed that either Kelly Peterson or Nicole Paquette lives more than 100 miles from the Capitol, and then that we have one more witness in favor of the bill, Chelsea Johnson, who lives more than 100 miles from the Capitol. It's our policy here to allow people who have traveled a long distance to testify. So if one of you would like to defer to a later panel, let's let Chelsea Johnson also be on the first panel.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Could I make a statement? This is one of the bills that I helped introduce.
Yes,
I just
please
wanted to,
go ahead,
I won't
Representative
go up front,
Roblin.
I just wanted to say a few things. Thank you. And again, Arnie Roblin, for the record. This is a very important bill. We spent a lot of time in the Agriculture Committee hearing this bill. And when we finally voted it out, the decision was that we were going to fix some things in the Senate. And we felt very strongly there was a lot of good testimony, especially about the breeding of hybrid cats and the ability to do that. And there were a number of businesses in there. And we had agreed at that time that we would take care of that in the Senate. With a lot of discussion, Representative Clem took and worked with a group of people and got a lot of input. We decided that we could do that here. The amendments you see in front of you are to make sure that that happens, that a business in Oregon that allows for the breeding of exotic cats with domestic cats, which creates a hybrid cat, which is not covered in this bill at all. Hybrid cats are okay for people to have. And there is a thriving business in our state with regard to raising those. And the amendments are set to do that. With that being said, it's very important from my perspective that we get control over exotic animals in the state. And Representative Boquist, who is unable to be here today, would love to have testified. He has other reasons, and I'll let, as we go on, if we need to, I'll put some of those out on the table. But the issue from Mary, if you look around the state, you're going to find more and more incidents of people who have taken exotic animals, especially the large ones, and crocodilia, which is also in here, and they've gotten out, and they have become a public hazard in communities from Coos Bay to all over the state. And we don't need that population of exotic animals in our state, whether it's tigers. And many of them live for extended lengths of time. And the people who have them have good intentions to keep them, but they die, other things happen, and they come. And as a high school principal, they came to the high school. They would come trying to find a place to put some of these animals and ask the science teachers if they could take them. And the science teachers would go about getting licenses and doing other kinds of stuff. And we can't take all of them, nor can the other places that we have today in our state take these animals. And I know that the people who raise them work very hard at trying to make sure that they find other people that do that. And I know that they try. And there are some very good owners. What we're saying in this bill is that the people who really have the ability, the zoos and the people who are exhibiting and showing for the right reasons, can continue to have their USDA licenses. But with respect to the state, we shouldn't be having ownership of exotic animals, except in the real definite change in this amendment. For those people that want to have several cats and others, the small under 50-pound cats that can then breed with a domestic cat to form these hybrids, which I don't know how many people have seen them, but they're pretty remarkable little animals. Even that is an issue, but we agreed in looking at this that that's something we should do. So with that, I'll end
this. Thank you for those comments. Please go ahead.
Hi, good morning. My name is Nicole Paquette, and I'm an attorney with the Animal Protection Institute, and I'm here on behalf of our Oregon members. I do want to thank you for allowing testimony on this bill. API is all too familiar with the keeping of exotic animals. We own and operate a primate sanctuary, which is home to over 400 monkeys, many of which that have been rescued from private pet situations. We've also assisted numerous states and cities across the country with their bills on prohibiting the future possession of exotics. HB 3437, as amended, does exempt persons holding a USDA license. Many of the people who testified at the past hearing, and probably many of the people here today, do hold a USDA license and thus are not affected by this bill. In addition, as Representative Roblin did say, we did take several amendments. We worked hard to come up with these amendments to address the main concerns. Just to go over the hybrid issue, we did look at addressing these domestic mixes. And again, the individuals are not affected by this bill. They simply have to obtain an ODA license, and they can continue with their practice. In addition, we have heard that several people, for whatever reason, fail to get a license when the bill is passed, even though they've had to already be licensed by ODA. For some reason, they do not have one. So again, we took out that urgency clause. So those individuals in this state who currently don't have a license do have 3 months from the effective date of the bill, and it's my understanding that the effective date is January 1, so that gives them almost eight months to get a license. As you can see, we have worked hard to fix these issues that the opponents raised. We, of course, thought that by taking these amendments, the opposition would either go neutral or, in fact, support this bill. However, this simply has not occurred. I do also want to point out that Oregon is one of 22 states that currently do not prohibit the private possession of exotic animals. 9 states have passed their prohibitions since 2004. And in fact, Washington State and Iowa passed their bills this year. So again, that means Oregon's bill is aligned with the national trend on this issue, and I did provide a handout for you. And lastly, I just want to address some of the incidents issues. The Animal Protection Institute, we did a national report on the exotic pet trade, which was featured on primetime last fall. And what we found was that there are numerous documented incidences that go unreported. What we have are incidences that are picked up in the newspapers. However, from various owners meeting with them in our investigation, we found that several of them have gone unreported, and we've also found poor animal care conditions, which I provided a handout as well. So Oregon has had its share of recent escapes. Thankfully, the animals were returned, and nothing happened to the individuals. However, that's not the case in other states. In Ohio, a woman was attacked by a bear that entered her home. In Kansas, a 17-year-old girl was killed by a tiger. And in Illinois, a girl was attacked by a monkey. And these all happened in the last couple of years. So, again, there are no hard statistics as to just how many incidences resulting in injury exist. But we do know from our investigation is that the exotic animal industry usually tries to minimize the risk. So, again, we really urge you to support this bill. It's a proactive step prior to something happening. And we respectfully urge your support of the bill and its amendments. Thanks.
Thank you. Please go ahead. And let me just point out for committee members, there was an emergency clause in the original version of the bill, but the -9 amendments do delete the emergency clause, so it would take effect in January. Please go ahead.
Good morning. My name is Chelsea Johnson, and I am here to support House Bill 3437. I'm the operations manager of a private chimpanzee sanctuary located in Central Oregon, and we have 8 chimpanzees and 2 Siberian lynx, which are exotic cats. Five of our chimps used to be pets, 2 of which were located in Oregon, and both of our lynx used to be pets. All of our animals have suffered mistreatment at the hands of humans, whether from neglect or abuse, and all of them have developed some psychological problems because of that abuse. Wild animals cannot be domesticated. It takes a long time to domesticate animals, and it can't be accomplished in just a few generations. In many cases where people have these animals as their pets, They only keep the animals for the first few years of their lives due to a lot of reasons. They kind of just lose their appeal after a while. They're not cute and cuddly like they were when they were young or fuzzy little kittens. And also, there's a huge financial strain on people to keep exotic animals as pets. They're very expensive to provide proper facilities for, proper food for. And also, they become very unpredictable and aggressive, especially when they hit sexual maturity. So people are ending up with these pets that they're afraid of and that they can't take care of anymore. Typically, zoos won't take animals that have been people's pets because they have severe psychological problems. They develop neurotic behaviors where they harm themselves and they harm other animals. And a lot of times, they can't be incorporated into other groups of animals because they don't know any species' typical behaviors. So a big solution for people that have had pets in the past has been that they can place them in sanctuaries. And sanctuaries provide a lifetime of care for these animals, and they're almost always a nonprofit organization that has to be stressed with the financial problems of taking care of these animals for the rest of their lives. But the problem now is that almost all sanctuaries that have primates or exotic cats are at capacity. There's no room for us to take any more primates, and I know that Chimps Incorporated is just one of 8 chimpanzee sanctuaries in the United States, and all chimpanzee sanctuaries are at capacity. We cannot take any more animals, and there's a waiting list of animals that are living in people's basements and their garages because they're afraid to go in with them. They're extremely aggressive, and they can't be placed anymore. More serious is what these people are going to do with the animals when they can't place them somewhere. All of these animals pose a huge threat to public safety, not only from the injuries. Injuries range from, you know, bites to even death. And the most serious is the zoonotic diseases that primates can pass to humans. Because we're so genetically similar, it enables primates to pass a lot of diseases, viral, bacterial, fungal, and diseases to humans, and it's a serious threat. Diseases like herpes B, which are rated alongside Ebola, are very fatal to humans, and about 25% of macaque species carry herpes B. And the problem is that pet owners not only don't know what kind of diseases their primates can carry, but they're not trained to recognize symptoms. And the scary thing is a lot of these animals can be asymptomatic carriers of these diseases. They never show any symptoms, so they can pass the diseases to man, and you'll never even recognize that they have the disease. And diseases like herpes B are fatal to man, and also tuberculosis is a very big concern on being a common disease found within primates that can be transmitted to man. So basically, I'm just here to urge that this bill is passed for public safety and for the care of animal safety and the animal welfare. So thank you.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Tony Vecchio. I'm the director of the Oregon Zoo and president of the Oregon Zoo Foundation. I've been in that position for 9 years, but I have 29 years in the zoo business working in 5 different accredited zoos. In the spirit of full disclosure, I should tell you that I know quite a few private individuals that own exotic animals. Some of them I call friends. They've been great help to me in my career. Some of these people are extremely knowledgeable about the animals they work with, more so than some of the zoo people I know. And I've called on them for help. And I know they also take great care of their animals. You will probably hear from some people like that today. Unfortunately, I've come to the conclusion after years and years in this business that those folks are clearly the minority. Most of the people that work with exotic animals get into it, I think, for the wrong reasons. As you just heard, I think it seems appealing when the animals are cute babies or when they think of how cool it would be to have a pet that's different than everybody else's. So they get in and probably quickly realize they're in over their heads. These are wild animals. And they can be dangerous, and they can be difficult to take care of. At the zoo, I would say on a very slow week, we get maybe one call from somebody who's trying to place an animal. This was news to me, but high school science teachers, too, getting the calls. I wasn't aware of that. I thought they all came to me. It seems that way. Like I said, one a week is a slow week for us. We sometimes get multiple calls a day from people that have snakes that have gotten too big, alligators that have gotten too big, primates that have gotten too unruly, big cats that are too expensive to take care of anymore, and they look for help. And it's extremely frustrating for me because usually the folks start off trying to sell the animals to me. And then when they realize I'm not going to buy them, they try to give them to me, and then they get very angry when they find out I'm not going to take them at all, because oftentimes they've been told that, well, if this doesn't work out, you can always sell it to the zoo. So I think some people get into this thinking the zoo is a way out for them. I would disagree with my esteemed colleague. We don't take animals very often, but it's not because we're afraid of the neurotic behaviors they have. In fact, most of our chimps were former pets that were abused and have those behaviors. We're willing to work with those. We have the same problem the sanctuaries have. We're full. We cannot take all the animals that come to us. There are too many of these animals out there. I would emphasize, again, the safety issues with these animals. At the zoo, we have 8 people that are certified shooters. They are allowed to fire firearms. They practice with the police at the police shooting range. We have an emergency response team, and we drill monthly to prepare for emergencies, which we know when you work with exotic animals are inevitable. No matter how good your facilities are, there are going to be times when there are emergencies, and we, as I said, we drill regularly to be prepared for those emergencies. It's something private individuals have a very difficult time being able to do. I know that many private individuals have outstanding facilities to keep their animals in. The issues I usually see come up when there's an emergency. If there's a fire or an ice storm and the animals have to be moved, when the animals are sick and have to be taken to the vet, that's when problems occur, when you have to take them out of your facilities, no matter how good those facilities are. When you put the animal in a different situation or you're doing something out of the routine, that's when emergencies happen that you need to be prepared to deal with. Any one of those, or any 2 or 3 of those shooters I talked about at the zoo could be off or on vacation, but we have a whole team of other people that are there to deal with the emergencies. When you're a single individual owning an exotic animal, you usually don't have that support network. In fact, the zoo is a publicly owned facility, so if I were to leave tomorrow, unfortunately for me, my boss isn't worried about it because he could hire another qualified zoo director in a heartbeat. But what I've seen oftentimes with private individuals is there is no long-term plan for what happens when that person is gone. I had a very good friend that I thought was one of the best I've ever known as far as working with big snakes, and he was a specialist in monitor lizards, a very large aggressive lizard. I considered him a friend and a consultant. I got a panicked call from his widow that he had died unexpectedly from a brain aneurysm. And now the woman and her daughter had a bunch of aggressive lizards and snakes and alligators in the basement that they didn't know how to take care of and didn't know what to do with, and really wanted me to help. And we just couldn't take them at the zoo. I did all I could to help find appropriate homes, but there are no appropriate homes for big, aggressive animals, so it was very hard. And then just as a final note, at the zoo we have 2 full-time veterinarians, 2 full-time veterinary technicians, and a keeper dedicated to the animals in the hospital. And even the vets now call in other vets to help. They call in specialists and human doctors all the time to help. It's just too big a job. It's too complex. Taking care of exotic animals is extremely difficult and expensive to do. And we have a full-time team devoted to it, and they are often overwhelmed.
I'm sorry. I think that our committee administrator forgot to set the timer, and if you could just wrap up, because we do have a lot of other people to testify.
Let me wrap up. I support this bill for all those reasons, mostly for the care of the animals and for the safety of the public. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Questions for this panel of witnesses? Yes, Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. It was alluded to before that there's been a number of incidents in the past few years of people getting, or exotic animals getting loose and whatnot. I'm just wondering how many have been injured, or how many people have contracted disease, like you alluded to earlier, or been killed.
Well,
In Oregon, there has been several recent escapes, and none of those resulted in any injury. However, nationwide, there, of course, have been numerous incidences. I don't have any hard statistics. Again, it's the only way we find out about incidences is through the newspapers, and also a lot of times when animals attack, they attack their owner typically, or people who come to the home, and then those incidences, what we found in our investigation, go unreported, and so they are afraid to go to the doctor, or they're afraid to report it because their animals will be confiscated. However, what I had mentioned was in the last couple of years there have been a woman died in Kansas from a tiger. A girl was attacked from a primate, a monkey, and also a woman was pretty brutally attacked by a bear that actually escaped from his home and wandered into her home. Those happen quite frequently. I mean, I get incidences probably every week where there's an escape. Probably at least once to twice a year there's a death. So again, we don't have hard statistics, but that's probably on average.
Follow up. I guess versus how many injuries and diseases and deaths have resulted from non-exotic cats and dogs. I'm just
Well, I think that's a hard comparison to make, given the fact that there are so many more animals that are so many more companion animals that are held in private homes. So your numbers are extremely skewed. So there are 60 to 70 million dogs in private homes, probably more cats as well. And when you're looking at exotics, that number is so much lower. So I think that's a really hard comparison to make.
I'm sorry, I do have another question. Is that okay?
Please
ask it, okay. And then we'll ask for a brief answer, but we do need to move
okay.
on.
Most of these animals, if I'm not mistaken, maybe correct me if I'm wrong, the people who have these animals are supposed to have permits, either through the Department of Ag or in the State Department or the USDA. Are you saying that's something you need to go beyond that and restrict the people who have these permits already? I'm just trying to understand the scope of this legislation.
Well, this particular bill doesn't affect the people who have a USDA license. So individuals who are exhibiting to the public or breeding animals, and those animals are then going across state lines. So as long as you're doing interstate breeding, you would then have to have a USDA license. Or if you're open to the public and any member of the general public enters your facility, you have to have a USDA license. This particular bill doesn't touch those people. It merely affects the people who own them as pets. The USDA does not license private individuals as pets. So what this bill does is phases out that system. It phases out the people who currently have an Oregon Department of Agriculture license holding those animals as pets. So you can keep them until they die. However, you cannot obtain any new ones.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. And next we'll take a panel of opponents of the bill, and we will call, looks like all the people that are from more than 100 miles, Mike Daly, Stephen Belknap, and Molly Schaefer.
I'm not 100 miles away. I don't.
Yeah, that's okay. And we are limiting people to 3 minutes, so if you could please put your testimony in that time or shorter, we would really appreciate it. Let's go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Mike Daly. I'm a county commissioner in Deschutes County. I also own a primate. I have a pet monkey that I've had since, my wife and I have had since for the last 12 years. This monkey was purchased in Oklahoma City, and primarily my wife had never had children in her life, so she elected to get a pet monkey, and he's been the light of our life, quite frankly, for 12 years. It fills a very big need in my family. I'm also a member of the National Simian Society of America. I'm a board member, and every year, I'm either in Salem or in the nation's capital fighting the Humane Society of the United States bills that are basically dropped in every state in the United States as well as federal. And they're primarily bills that ban the private ownership of exotic animals. And, you know, I don't disagree with a lot of that stuff. I don't disagree that you shouldn't have a 400-pound chimpanzee in your backyard or a full-grown lion in your backyard. I think that we all agree that that's not good and it shouldn't happen. But we also have to take into account folks like myself who have a small 18-pound capuchin monkey that fills a huge need in my family. And that my wife, never having children of her own, this is her child. And we look at him and we consider him as our own child. It would be the same as if we lost our own child, you know, through a death or something. We'd feel just as badly. And there's no doubt in my mind about that. And the people that I know nationwide, other board members from the Seamen Society of America, all feel exactly the same way. And as far as monkeys, pet monkeys, something like that, if something happens to my wife and I, we have a nationwide organization that will come in and take our animal and take care of them. Pet monkeys, now we don't have a nationwide organization that will take chimpanzees or gorillas, stuff like that. But the smaller animals, yes, we do. Humane Society of the United States, a worldwide organization, in the last count they had $200 million in assets on their last tax return. We can't continue. We work very hard to try to work with these people, but they have one agenda, and that's ban all private ownership of exotic animals. And I don't doubt that we could probably come to some agreement on something that would work for everybody, but we've never been able to get them to the table. So, you know, they just push their own agenda, and that's all they want to do.
And I'm sorry, your 3 minutes are up. If you could just conclude your testimony.
All right. As far as the diseases that monkeys carry, I think if any of you folks would ask your staff to call the Center for Disease Control, you would find out that that's totally false. There are just no incidents in the United States other than imported monkeys that have passed exotic disease, and I think I only know of two in the history of the United States, and Centers for Disease Control will tell you that also. I'm just saying, please, the constituents at this table are your constituents. This bill is faulty in one respect in that it does not allow, I need to get one more point, Madam Chair. This bill does not allow for us folks who are USDA licensed. If USDA goes away, there's no way that we can get legal. This bill is flawed in that respect. And USDA could go away because there are federal legislation pending right now that could cause USDA to not issue licenses anymore. There's no way for any of us to get legal. And that's the only thing I want you to understand. Okay? Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Please go ahead.
Okay. Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Stephen Belknap. I have owned and raised exotic animals for 24 years. My animals have been placed in zoos, educational facilities, and all around the world, actually. A native Oregonian. It was stated earlier that we didn't have any statistics or data in Oregon. That is not true. Don Hansen, the state veterinarian for the state of Oregon, has indicated in the past 4 years there have been 4 escapes of exotic animals in Oregon. In none of those instances was there any injury or damage to anyone or personal injury. This bill is being pushed as a safety issue. Well, when the facts and figures and statistics show that the safety of Oregon is not being compromised because of the keeping of these exotic animals. Current regulations require that owners of these animals either have a state permit or a federal permit. With that permit comes yearly or biannual inspections by a veterinarian to ensure the safety of the public and the proper caging and veterinary care of the animals. Because of that, the safety issue in Oregon doesn't exist that we see in other states because of the existing permit system. The system works. It doesn't need to be changed. It doesn't need to be fixed. Very few other states have a system that requires every animal to have a permit in one way or another. And I'm just asking you to not allow the out-of-state radical animal rights activists to control the legislature with their lies, inaccuracy, and extreme right views. Help keep responsible animal ownership in Oregon legal and vote no on 3437. Thank you.
Please go ahead.
Good morning. Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, my name is Molly Schaefer. I've operated a USDA licensed facility in Marion County for the past 22 years. A number of you have already met with me in person and know the many reasons I oppose this bill. Today I'm going to ask that you remember a name. That name is Michael Grimm. Michael Grimm strongly opposes this bill and is unable to be here today. Michael is a sergeant in the U.S. Army. He's 27 years old and spent his childhood surrounded by animals, exotic and otherwise, and they're a very important part of his life. They enriched his childhood, and taking care of them helped to teach him responsibility and respect and the importance of putting someone else's needs above your own. Michael knows that personal freedom is what makes this country the strongest and best nation in the world, and he feels so strongly about the right to personal freedom that he volunteered to go to a country where there were no personal freedoms and put his life on the line. Michael feels good about the fact that he's not only defending the freedoms of the American people, but he's helping to bring some of those freedoms to a very oppressed country of people. He feels so strongly about personal liberties and the American way of life that he's willing to leave his family and his wife to go to a foreign country where he's been shot at, has carried heavy gear while working in extreme heat, and has watched as his friends and comrades get blown up around him. Michael recently, after serving two tours in the Middle East, reenlisted knowing he would get sent back again to the same conditions. Michael Grimm is my son, and I'm very proud of him. He and other members of our younger generations are why I'm here today staunchly opposing this bill. While my son is putting his life on the line to ensure our freedoms, we sit here today talking about taking the simple freedom to own his pets away from him. I hope proponents of this bill will be willing to explain to him the next time he comes home, if he comes home, why it is you felt the need to take his freedoms away while he was gone fighting for yours. This bill is obviously not a health and safety bill, as it prohibits all exotic animals, including those that pose no danger and never could. This bill is nothing more than a special interest group's attempt to use our legislature to promote their anti-animal agenda. If you read API's website, you will see API doesn't even think you should be able to own your own dog. Today it's exotic animals. Tomorrow I guarantee it will be your family pet. Please don't let these special interest groups take away our rights by changing current laws that adequately regulate exotic animal ownership and replace them with an all-out prohibition. As the history of our country has proven repeatedly, regulation keeps people accountable and honest. Prohibition makes criminals out of good law-abiding citizens. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Any questions for these witnesses?
Pretty quickly, Madam Chair.
Yes, Vice Chair Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Buckley, just for my education, when the annual or biannual inspection, does that include a vet coming to the
veterinary
home?
Yes, the state vet. Okay. Inspects your facilities, your caging, your feeding program, and veterinary program.
Even just for a private
private owner, yes.
Thank you very much.
Anyone ODA licensed.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. And next we'll call another panel of supporters of the bill. We'll call Kelly Peterson, Glenn Kolb, and Susan Mentley. Could you please just seat yourselves and start as soon as you are seated?
I'll start.
Go ahead.
Chair Rosenbaum and committee members, thanks for the opportunity for testifying. My name is Kelly Peterson, and I'm the Oregon Program Director for the Humane Society of the United States. I'm here today representing our 130,000 Oregon members and constituents. Right off the top, I just have to address, I'm a native Oregonian from Lebanon, Oregon. I've been here all my life. I am certainly not an out-of-state animal activist. And, boy, I feel like HSUS is very reflective of our membership, and so we're here in support of the bill. I just, a lot of the points have been made, but I did want to address that the previous folks who do come up and testify, they all have USDA licenses, so they would be exempt from the bill. They would be allowed to continue to breed and to exhibit. I just wanted to address just briefly what the bill does, and I do think Nicole Paquette addressed a little bit, and also Representative Roblin, but it just phases out the issuance of the state permits by the Oregon Department of Agriculture, and then it also adds the whole family of the crocodilia to the licenses. And each person would be able to keep their animal, and they just would not be able to get additional permits through the Oregon Department of Agriculture. But those people who have a USDA license can continue to breed and exhibit, and they're just in no way affected by this. And also, I'm not also aware of any federal legislation that would take away the USDA license. I don't know of any pending regulation. I haven't heard of that at all. And so I just wanted to address that. And with that, I know time is valuable, so I'll just, if you have questions afterwards, I'm happy to address them.
Please go ahead.
Well, good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Glenn Cole. I'm executive director with the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association. I don't believe veterinarians are a very radical group. And we do support this bill for many of the same reasons that the previous proponents have spoken and Kelly Peterson has. So I'm going to keep it that because they did address our issues. We have had a longstanding position statement as well as our national association, the American Veterinary Medical Association, in opposition to the keeping and breeding of captive wild and exotic animals, and we do support this legislation.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Susan Mentley, and I'm from the Oregon Humane Society, which is based in Portland. And I worked here in the Marion County Animal Shelter at the Willamette Humane Society for 16 years, 2 years in Bend and Redmond. And at the Oregon Humane Society, I've currently been there for 9 years. And the only reason I'm telling you this is I've had enough experience in the animal shelter background to know that the large exotics, as we call them, are a pain in the neck. I called the Department of Oregon Department of Agriculture last week to get a sense of what kind of numbers we were looking at and any types of, you know, findings or if they had trends. They weren't able to give me a lot of good, hard data, but there was some anecdotal things. Turned out I knew the woman, had known her for many years, and she said that there are a lot of animals out there in Oregon, and the lions, tigers, bears, the big ones. Lots of different types of large cats, too. It is true that an inspector goes out every other year, so you can imagine that that's a pretty large expenditure. I'm sure they're all over the state, so there's some good travel there. But curiously, if there's a problem or any type of infraction, they write it up, and then they turn it over to local law enforcement. That just stunned me. I think of the last thing local municipalities, police, or sheriff's departments want to do is get involved with large-scale, large animal seizures. I can't even imagine how they would approach that. Well, I can, because the first thing they do is they call us. And in the animal shelter business, we're built for dogs and cats and little stuff. I have worked at a couple of shelters where we have had large animals. I can just imagine what our insurance company would think if they found out that we had leggers or tigers or bears or whatever in our shelter. We have tons of staff and tons of volunteers, and you know, we just can't go there. So, of course, we would refer them to sanctuaries. And you've already heard that sanctuaries are full. Often, if there is a seizure, obviously, it's a court case. It goes to trial. No, there's just no reason for the trial to be speedy at all. They usually take months and months, and the costs just go up and up. So I was just really interested to hear that local law enforcement was expected to do the enforcement of whatever the Department of Agriculture and Veterinarians found. We've helped, just recently we helped the city of Hillsborough with 200 rabbits, and they just thought it was the worst thing in the world, and I kept saying, hey, it could be tigers, you know, they're just rabbits, but it was very expensive and long, and it was a really hard case, so I just wanted to mention that. I think that's it.
Good, because your time is
because
up.
Because my time's up. Okay, thank you very much.
Great, thank you for your testimony. Any questions for these witnesses? Yes, Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Several of you, at least you talked about large exotic animals, which seems to be if we're talking about lions and tigers and bears, I'm not aware of small, kind of cuddly lions and tigers and bears. But talk about, as I'm reading the bill, it does reference, it seems to be more broadly inclusive than just large primates. I mean, the fact that it would cover even an 18-pound monkey if it did not have a USDA permit. Talk about is there a gap between the clear problem related to large exotics and the at least what appears to be a more broadly inclusive language in this bill?
You know, I'm not really prepared for to answer to the language, but I can tell you that even a small macaque monkey can do a tremendous amount of damage. These aren't domesticated animals; they're wild, and they have teeth. And you know, even a 15-pound domestic cat can do a lot of damage. So, as I understand it, the bill includes any non-human primate, and that would be the small ones as well.
Right. It would also. Chair Roblin and Representative Hunt, it would include any non-human primate, and then also wild felines, wolves, non-native wild canids, and bears. And so it's the animals that the Oregon Department of Agriculture already regulates, and then we're also adding crocodiles and alligators, and then phasing out the state program. It would be all primates.
And I did have a question for you. I think Kelly would be the best one to answer this. The bill allows people who currently hold a permit from the USDA to continue to own their animals and breed them, mm-hmm. and then
acquire new ones even.
Okay. And private owners, are they also grandfathered in under this bill?
Chair Rosenbaum, private owners who have an Oregon Department of Agriculture license are grandfathered in. They cannot breed their animal, mm-hmm. and they can acquire another one, but they can continue to keep that animal until, you know, the duration of its life.
They wouldn't be able to acquire a new animal?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Thanks. Yes, I'm Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Kelly. You're with the Humane Society mm-hmm. of the United States.
Correct.
And you're the Oregon director.
Yes.
Well, I had seen something, and maybe you can just clarify. It's a policy of the Humane Society of the United States that people shouldn't own animals, and I'm wondering if that's a view you would also espouse.
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Thatcher, shouldn't own dogs and cats, pets?
Animals, I guess.
Oh, that's completely untrue. We have a policy at the Humane Society of the United States, people bring their dogs into work, and so I have heard that before. I have no idea where that comes from.
Okay.
I can tell you we are incredibly sympathetic, and probably all of us have more animals than we probably should with respect to it's hard to stop at one dog. And so, I hear that a lot, and it's frustrating. But I can tell you we all love animals.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. We have one more witness, but they didn't sign up their name. It says Hart's Reptile World.
Yeah.
Okay, and if you could come forward. And I'm sure you heard we're limiting people to 3 minutes or less.
Oh, yeah.
Would be even better.
We can be brief. I'm Mary Esther Hart from Hart's Reptile World. This is one of my associates, Linda. And we're the odd people out. Everybody's really happy to tell you about the USDA permit. Reptiles are not regulated under USDA. Now, I do want to start off by saying that I did have a meeting, or we had a meeting, with Representative Boquist to point out that we didn't qualify under this to be exempt. And we're kind of the dinosaurs in the area here of reptiles as far as doing rescue since 1975. And our adoption process makes the Humane Society of the United States look like they give animals away. The problem that I see is not the buyers of these animals. It's the sellers of the animals. I actually started out supporting this bill, but have now kind of went over to the other side. Unless there's some major changes, I see this as a problem for kids in the future that would be like me or some of the other people here. They wouldn't have the opportunity to have the animals, but there are two things you can do. I have muscle disease, so excuse my talking or incapable of talking. Two things you could do to solve this problem. One would be liability insurance. Who doesn't know their insurance person would throw the book at them if they didn't do it right?
I carry $1 million liability insurance. My insurance company loves me because I'm overcautious. I mean, if my philosophy is if in doubt, don't do. So, and another one would be a mentoring program that has worked for raptors for years. Why not exotic animals? When somebody calls, in particular, they want a big python or an alligator or crocodile, I'm interested in their immediate utterance. I ask them, why do you want something, and notice I'm not using the word pet here, why do you want something that can kill you? I'm interested in their response. Very few of those, well, actually none, have ever gotten any. So, because they want them for the wrong reason, I am a responsible adopter out. As a matter of fact, I had an aquarium, who I will leave the name blank, who wanted a big python, and I do have a big python that I'm looking for a home. And this is an AZA-recognized institution. They don't qualify under my thing. And in this, I don't see it now, but it was in there. If you were AZA, you know, you could get it. They didn't qualify for me. They are a multi-million dollar operation, any of the AZAs. They didn't qualify and won't to get the animal. So I think there's solutions here that nobody has brought up or even considered. There's alternatives that could solve the problem. And it's not the owners, it's the sellers.
Your time's up. Thanks for your testimony. And did you wish to testify as well?
Hi. Hi, Madam Chair. Good morning, members of the House. I just wanted...
Could you please state your name for the...
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Linda Rainin, and I work with Hearts Reptile World. There was just a couple of points I wanted to make quickly. The first is that, first and foremost, we're concerned with the well-being of the animals, and what my biggest concern is that by banning instead of regulating, we're going to create a black market in which the animals are going to be hidden and in conditions that are going to hurt them. They're not going to receive proper veterinary care because you're not going to be able to take your animal to a veterinarian for fear of having it taken away from you. When someone has an incident where they're injured by the animal, they're not going to seek medical care. I'm not familiar with mammals, with exotic mammals, but crocodilian bites, the reason why they're harmful to people isn't usually because of the damage the teeth do, it's because of the bacteria the animals carry in their mouth, and if someone isn't treated with antibiotics, they can become infected. So if you don't go to a doctor, you're not going to get treated for it. That was one point, and then I wanted to address your question about the... You had asked about what Molly said about the Humane Society and not wanting people to keep animals. It actually was the API site that Molly referred to, not the Humane Society site.
Just to clarify, it was just something I'd seen from the Humane Society.
Oh, okay. You were talking about something separate from her reference to it? That's it. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for your testimony. Any questions for these witnesses?
Can I just ask, what is it exactly you do?
We're a reptile rescue that do education programs. I'm also not, and one reason that the AZA institution doesn't want it, the guy comes to a rescue to get a big python. And I asked the guy, I said, do you see this picture the way I'm seeing this picture? He wanted it, first of all, for breeding. And I said, you've come to a rescue. Doesn't that tell you there's a problem? And if you, an AZA multi-million dollar organization, is going to breed that animal, what are you going to do with those babies? So just because somebody, you know, is nonprofit and they look good doesn't mean they're qualified, at least in our book. So, nonprofit, and we are not nonprofit. If this bill would have passed without exemptions to it, Oregon, I showed Bocas where Oregon would have been the only state that had no-kill facilities. We are absolutely If the animal is suffering, yes. If a person would be hurt, yes. Other than that, there's absolutely no excuse to kill a perfectly healthy animal. We have, of course, we've been around for a long time, so we do. We have a nationwide network of animals that we can call people in different areas that they will pick.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for your... Yes, Representative Roblin?
No. As the bill's written, you guys are exempt from this.
Yes, I did want to state that. We fall under the education, so, but I'd like to think I'm representing the young people that won't have the opportunity. A mentoring program would be great, because we have a lot of people come out with us. They think they want a particular animal, whereas if they didn't have a mentoring program, they went to the pet store and they bought it and go, oh, darn, now what? It wasn't what I thought. They can come out and mentor at a place that has the animal that they want and let them do the dirty work. Don't just, you know, give them the fluffy stuff, the pet stuff. Let them clean the cage. Let them wrestle the animal. Rarely does anybody ever want it. You know, that's the way to go. Rather than banning people, you haven't stopped them from getting it. Educate them and let them learn through their own experience why they don't want it.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
And that completes our sign-up sheet. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3437, and I'll open a work session on House Bill 3437. And, yes, Vice Chair Berger.
Madam Chair, I move the -9 amendments to House Bill 3437.
Vice Chair Berger moves the -9 amendments to House Bill 3437. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Amendments are adopted. And Vice Chair Berger.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3437 as amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Berger moves House Bill 3437 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
To mention that.
Yes, Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. Just to mention, until I feel comfortable with what the amendments actually do, I'll probably be a no for now. So, thanks.
Further discussion? Yes, Representative Roble.
I would just like to say that, you know, I appreciate the work that people did to make this a better bill, so we can send it to the Senate in a better form, and I hope that as you look at those amendments and understand what they do, you'll feel better with that. And also would ask, as we consider who's going to carry this, this bill was carried by Representative Boquist before, and I would like to allow him to continue to carry that, or I would do it either one, but the two of us were on there, but he was scheduled earlier, and I think that would be good. And he has some comments with regard to the exotic animal trade worldwide and what it does in fueling other programs out there that the terrorist programs in certain countries that is another interest that we didn't get really to talk about a lot here. So with that, I would say.
Thank you. And Shana, please call the roll.
Representative
Berger? Aye.
Representative
Espo?
Aye.
Representative
Hunt?
Aye.
Representative
Roland?
Aye.
Representative
Buckley? Excused. Aye. Motion carries. And we will ask Representative Boquist to carry this. If he does not wish to, we will ask we'll have Roblin. Okay, we have one more bill remaining on our agenda for today. We may be pressing our luck with the Sergeant at Arms, but I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3294. And it looks like we have -8 amendments, and Representative Hunt. I believe those come from you, so would you like
yes.
to tell us about them?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. You will recall we heard this bill, I don't know when this was, a little over a week ago. And so we've tried to incorporate in several of the changes. Maybe I can just go through the -8s and talk about what the changes are from the previous amendments so you are aware of them. On the first page of the -8s to House Bill 3294, there was a suggestion from Mr. McDonald from the United Vets Group that we should actually expand out beyond just the prohibition on dishonorable discharge. So you'll notice in both line 11 and line 14, it also adds a bad conduct as well as a dishonorable discharge as prohibitions. Now this, and then it also does add in line 16 through 20, our additions to further clarify. This definition is one that's actually just lifted out of another part of statute, that was adopted. The Veterans Committee in 2005 heard hours and hours and hours of testimony around trying to come up with the right definition for what a veteran should mean. This is the definition that came up in the 05 session, so this language is just lifted right out of statute. The one change is the one I just mentioned, adding the bad conduct prohibition, which I consulted with Representative Boquist, who served on the 05 Veterans Committee as well as this Veterans Committee, and he thought that was an acceptable change. If you jump all the way to page... Actually, the last page, page 10. Those are the other changes from the previous amendment. Again, at the suggestion of Mr. McDonald, we added on lines 4. Again, we're on page 10 of the dash 8 amendments. On page 10, line 4 and line 9, congressionally chartered veterans organizations are specifically delineated as part of the charge of this new training and certification committee. And I'm trying to read my own notes here. There is another change. Oh, and actually in line 16 and following, it more clearly says that the Director of Veterans Affairs shall appoint 3 members that are at his discretion. They can come from his own staff or the congressionally chartered vets groups, and then 3 additional persons who would come from the Association of County VSOs. So we tried to incorporate several changes. There were obviously other concerns that were raised at the last hearing. In consulting with Representative Boquist, he and I both believe that this is the place, that this is the sweet spot in terms of where this bill might best address the core concerns that have been raised, largely related to making sure that we've got much better collaboration and cooperation between county veteran service officers, who we heard in the testimony at our previous hearing, are so key to getting service and benefits for our vets and the State Department of Veterans Affairs. As well as the second piece of making sure that we've got, that as we send out dollars, that those really do go out proportionally to counties throughout the state to make sure that veterans in every county in Oregon have access to services.
Okay, thank you for that explanation. We are in a work session, but I believe there might be some people in the audience that want to speak about these amendments, so we will allow testimony, limited testimony, if you wish to come forward. Do you think you can limit your testimony to 3 minutes each?
I'll do the best I can, ma'am.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paula Brown. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And we certainly appreciate at the department some of the changes that were made and are in agreement with some of the other ones, specifically the removal of war as a description for veterans, for war veterans. What I would like to do is just provide a little information relative to the relationship between the department and the county veteran service officers. During the interim, the department has worked very hard to ensure that we have a very cooperative and collaborative relationship with county veteran service officers, national service officers from the veterans organizations, and the Department of Veterans Affairs. We have a statewide delivery system for providing services to veterans in the state, and it consists of those 3 different service officers. What the department did was we made sure that we had some discussion about legislative concepts, provided copies of our budget, continued relationships and meetings with County Veteran Service Officer Association leadership, and provided copies of our ways and means document and requested input from the organization to ensure that we were moving forward in a collaborative and supportive way. Unfortunately, I think perhaps it has been represented that perhaps that relationship is not as good as the department and the association leadership believes. I can't answer that question because my experience has been that we do have a good relationship with them. The concern that we have, we're certainly happy to have a committee. We already have a training committee with the County Veteran Service Officers serving on that committee. We'd be happy to continue that kind of a relationship. What we have asked is that we would have equal representation of all the three different partners who are providing those services. And with that, we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Please go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Matt McDonald from United Veterans of Oregon. And I'll go down page by page and very quickly go through it. I delete on page 1, line 10, 178, as the federal government recognizes 90 days.
Mac, what document are you working from?
I'm working for the changes that I...
The Dash 8 Amendment?
Dash 8 Amendment.
Okay.
Page 1, page 1, line 10, says 178. I changed that to 90. It's the federal government recognizes 90 days as a veteran. I do that again on line 13. On page 1, line 14, I changed dishonorable and bad conduct discharge to discharge on honorable conditions because that's the people that get the benefits. And if the law ever changes, which it has changed just recently, they dropped one of the discharges. You'll never have to change this bill again if it says discharged under honorable conditions. And the same thing goes for page 1, line 17 and 18. I delete the bad conduct dishonorable and just put under honorable conditions. Page 2, lines 8, 9, and 10, the following language. I leave the following language in so that the existing statute remains currently as in effect. The appointment may not be made without the written approval of the advisory committee provided in ORS. The reason for this is to keep the Department of Veterans Affairs non-political. When Governor Goldschmidt became governor, he wanted to appoint a man from California as the director of Veterans Affairs. The board, the advisory board, said, no, John Mangus is doing a great job. Why should we replace him with someone we don't know? And it gives the veterans a voice in who would be the director of Veterans Affairs. It's been used once in 62 years. It's a good thing. It's just a check to keep it non-political. We'd like it to remain the same. In page 8, lines 13 and 14, delete apply only the following and leave in. Consider, and that include but not limited to. So the existing statute remains as it currently exists and reads. In developing the distribution formula for the director shall consider the factors included but not limited to, because there are other factors that take in consideration. An example, Multnomah County has one county veteran service officer, spends less than a dollar per veteran in that county for all the veterans, 54,000 of them. But it also has 15 state and federal service officers that Multnomah County does not want to count. That one service officer that they have there now has spent half his time down here at the legislature not serving veterans, but lobbying to get it so Multnomah County gets more money. We feel it's unfair to disregard 15 federal and national service officers, state and national service officers that are in the federal building that are doing the job for Multnomah County as well as the one service officer. So we feel that it's unrealistic to restrict the Director of Veterans Affairs to limit it to just the number of veterans living in that county. What that will mean if this bill passes, that we're taking money from every other county in the state of Oregon and giving it to Multnomah County.
Thank you. And your 3 minutes have elapsed. I'll ask you to just kind of summarize the rest of your testimony if you can. I think the members do have a copy of the suggested changes that you're going through right now in an email form.
Or the perhaps they do not. I have a copy of that. Okay.
Yes.
I think it was at your
attached to the email.
If you could just summarize the rest of it.
If I just summarize up on page 10, section 1, the training and certification group, we'd like to have it 3 county veteran service officers, 3 appointed by the Director of Veterans Affairs, and 3 from congressionally chartered veterans organizations. We feel the veterans should have a word to say in it. We think if the changes are not made, the United Veterans of Oregon requests that you vote no on this bill.
Okay, please go ahead.
Yes. Madam Chair, thank you. I'm Stahl Austin. I'm currently a member of the Advisory Committee of the Director of Veterans Affairs. I'm also a former director of the department. I'm also a Marion County veteran. And my concern at this point is on page 9, starting on line 23, the language as it's written there statutorily precludes Marion and Polk counties from receiving any outreach funds for veterans from any of the current appropriations, including Senate Bill 1100 from last session and the department's budget this session. Because they do not have, neither one of those counties have a county service officer. They used to have. They found out that there were service officers in the Department of Veterans Affairs who could serve the counties, so they don't have a service officer anymore. But the director can't even use the money that would normally go for outreach to them if they had a service officer to do that outreach for them. So I would ask you to at least consider changing that part of the bill. Thank you.
Yeah, Representative Hunt.
Can I just basically ask a question of Paula? Because my memory is that that section lines 23 through 30 actually came, that was an ODVA suggestion that we incorporated into the bill.
This was on page 9?
Right, page 9, lines 23 through 30. I think we just took the language as you suggested it, so.
That's correct. The department, Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Hunt, the department did provide that language. I think that General Austin has provided a very good tweak because it does address the issue of the outreach funds. But yes, you are correct.
So if I could follow up.
Yeah, follow up.
So as you look at this language, is his interpretation correct that this would negatively impact Marion and Polk County?
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Hunt, that is correct. What the department was primarily looking at when we provided some draft language was that if a county that was receiving the monies for expansion and enhancement were to, for whatever reason, by any fault of their own or not be able to continue their services, then those monies would come to the department to ensure those veterans were served. The issue that Starl Austin brings up is that Marion and Polk have never gotten the enhancement or expansion funds and therefore would be left out. So the suggestion by Mr. Austin is to ensure that outreach funds are provided to the department for Marion and Polk counties.
Yes, Representative.
Maybe if you could get, since we just adopted in that section the language provided by ODVA, if you could just get new language that addresses that concern, we'd be happy to look at that. That's the first I'm hearing of that concern. Paul, let me ask you, in terms of the, you talked about the kind of the representation on the committee and the suggestion instead of having 3 folks appointed by the director that could come from either state or congressionally chartered groups and 3 from the county VSOs. My understanding is that there is not a proportional, that there are far more county VSOs than there are, for instance, congressionally chartered groups. Isn't that correct?
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Hunt, you're absolutely correct. The concern, however, that we hear from veterans and from the National Service Officers is because of that delivery system. They'd like equal representation. State service office or county veteran service officers, our department service officers, and then the national service officers would all be required to be certified under the state certification program. And I think what they're looking for is they would like equal representation on the committee that comes up with the criteria for that certification.
If I have one last
question.
And I think this is to Mac. in terms of the proposed changes on page one, were those changes suggested in terms of the, since the Veterans Affairs Committee went through that extensive process in 05, I don't know if they looked at this again this year.
We've tried to change it throughout so it says under honorable conditions. That way you'll never have to change this law again, because that's the people that get the benefits from the Department of Veterans Affairs. If they change and come up with, let's say, a new discharge, one used to be undesirable discharge. Well, that's not under honorable conditions. Anytime the federal government changes the law, one way or the other, it's always the person that gets the benefits is under honorable conditions. Therefore, if you say under honorable conditions and they change the law, you're not going to have to change this law.
Follow up.
So
you suggested that to the House Veterans Affairs Committee, and they just chose not to make that change. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. Thanks.
Chair Rosenbaum,
yes.
If I may, just to address the page 9 amendment. In the amendment that the United Veterans Group provided to me, there is some suggested language that would take care of the counties, whether they reduced or eliminate, whether they do that in the future or whether they've already done that. Now, for the department, our budget is already passed. The dollars per county are already indicated for the exact amount, so it wouldn't affect the funding that is going to the counties this session. What it would mean is that moving forward in the future, the department would be able to request funds so that Marion and Polk would have the ability to use some of those enhancement and expansion funds for outreach. Thank you.
I have the change here, Representative Rosenbaum. I can give it to you. In fact, I'll just give you all of what we propose to United Veterans of Oregon, and you can make copies for the rest of the committee.
I think that would be great. Okay. Other questions for these witnesses?
Yes, Vice Chair Berger.
Madam Chair, the 90-day versus 178 days of MAC, which is
the federal government changed the law. It used to be 180 days, and in the 05 session we changed it to 178 for state personnel. The law has recently been changed to 90 days, federal law.
Okay. Thank you. And one other question.
Yeah.
Am I clear that there is some language out there that would ensure that Marion and Polk get the services that other counties?
I have it right here.
I just want to be sure that there's a way of getting there. Thank
you. Yeah, and Mac, I actually, or maybe Paula, I am looking at your email, and it doesn't really. If you could provide that to the. I'm not sure this really tracks, because it looks like it deletes a phrase in line 25 on page 9, and then after the deletions puts in new language, which doesn't really track from what you're proposing. So you might take another look and just make sure that does what you're intending it to do.
Yeah.
Okay.
If it's the same as what you were provided.
Okay. I'll make sure I do that and get that to you.
And yes, thank you. I just wanted to verify something. I got an email. It said this is an extremely bad bill. We can turn control of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs over to the Association of Oregon Counties. I'm just wondering how you would answer that with, in light of the amendment.
Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher. What that talks about, it talks about the committee at the end on page 10. And it's three from county veteran service officers, and it's three from Department of Veterans Affairs. And what the veterans are upset about is the Congressional Chartered Veterans Organization, all 18 of them, feel that they're really being left out, and they'd like to have three representatives there also.
So it's not addressed in this amendment, then?
Well, it's addressing Dash 8 here, because Dash 8 just has, Dash 8 leaves out basically the congressionally chartered organizations and leaves out their national service officers. And if you have three from the county veteran service officers and three from the Department of Veterans Affairs, and if there's any problems, it's going to be a 50-50 split. If you add the three in from the Department of from the veterans organizations, there'll be nine people, so there'll never be an even split.
I see. Okay, thank you for your testimony. Members, it looks like we are under call of the House, so we will carry this bill over to our hearing on Wednesday. We do intend to move it out on Wednesday, so that will be your last chance. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 3294. And with nothing further to come before us today, members, we are adjourned.
Thank you.